This episode of Into the Wild is brought to you by Leica Sport Optics. Leica products are the creation of over 100 years of knowledge in developing and manufacturing optical systems. Their quest? Simple. Creating awareness and bringing people closer to the wonders of nature. In an era of increasingly threatened wilderness, Leica serve those who treasure it most by promising and delivering the ability to see wildlife as you've never seen it before. The binoculars I decided to go with? The Trinovid HDs. First conceived in 1958, they are the binoculars designed for the widest array of uses. They expertly combine high-definition optical performance, outstanding mechanical features, and easy, intuitive operation in a durable form. When I use them, it was like having HD TV for my eyes. Hello and welcome to Into the Wild, the podcast that brings you wildlife facts, conservation updates, and nature stories from the professionals to you. Before we start, I'd like to quickly announce that Into the Wild now has its very own Patreon page. For those of you that don't know what Patreon is, let me quickly explain. It's a page where you, the listeners, can now support the show, and in return, get rewarded. Into the Wild is offering its Patreon users early access to every single episode. You can unlock exclusive and bonus shows, have a sneak peek at deleted questions and scenes from the regular episodes, and we'll even be doing live interviews for Patreon users only. You can head over to www.patreon.com/IntoTheWildPodcast to support us. By doing so, you'll not only be helping Into the Wild continue, but helping us grow to even bigger things. And now, on with the show. Oof, put the heat in on and make me a brew, it's winter! A time of year that many of us shiver at, or prefer to hibernate under the duvet with some snacks and a Netflix marathon. But should we appreciate it more? This week I spoke to zoologist and wildlife presenter Megan McCubbin as she gears up for the next instalment of BBC's The Watchers with Winter Watch. Megan dives into telling us what winter is all about for nature and why it really is a drastic time for wildlife, and combining that with what we can look out for both in the sticks and in the cities. We also discuss the watches themselves and talk about how different they've been in the last year with the many lockdowns that we have all faced. And last but certainly not least, I asked Megan how a project of hers and her stepdad's, the Self-Isolating Bird Club, came to be. So thanks so much for tuning in and enjoy the show. Hi Megan, welcome to Into the Wild. Thanks so much for joining me. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Thank you very much for having me on. I'm really looking forward to it.
No, it's an absolute pleasure. It's lovely to get the chance to talk to you. Before I do, let's start with a very basic question of, can you start by telling us who you are and what is it you do?
Sure. So my name is Megan McCubbin. I suppose, first and foremost, I'm a zoologist. I've got a fascination with natural history and how things work. And I'm really interested in science communication, so how to kind of portray key scientific concepts to a larger audience and kind of gain interest and get people involved. So I started out TV presenting. This year I've been on Autumn Watch, I've been on Spring Watch, and just about to head into Winter Watch. And I've just written a book as well. So lots of different elements to what I do. It's always different, which is good, but it's all centered around natural history.
Yeah, the last year, I just said before we recorded, has been mega busy for you, hasn't it?
It's been a bit of a whirlwind, yeah. It's been a bit of a change. You know, beforehand, I mean, I've been presenting since 2017, something that I never aimed to get into. It just kind of evolved that way, which is brilliant because I do really enjoy it. That was all kind of pre-recorded films that I did here and there. And then lockdown happened and Chris Packham and I started something called the Self-Isolating Bird Club, where we broadcast an hour a day to the nation talking about wildlife in our garden that we thought was special, and wanted to share that with the rest of the country and further on, because we felt that some people might not have access to sufficient green space or gardens, and we wanted to showcase what we were seeing that was helping us to try and help other people. And it turned into this massive production. Well, I say massive production, it was quite small, it was all done on our mobile phones. I say massive production because we got Fabian Harrison involved, who is a tech genius, and he kind of got live guests in from around the world, and it turned into the most amazing community of people just having inspiring conversations, giving tips, and just making each other feel better, which was really lovely to see. And then kind of from that Springwatch happened, and I kind of got the phone call saying, you know, you've done that South Wales Boat Club, but you fancy just coming on Springwatch and seeing what happens. And I was kind of taken aback by it, but absolutely, you know, it was an amazing opportunity, and it's all kind of gone from there, I suppose.
Yeah, that's incredible to go from like this self-isolating bird club you started. Do you want to come on national TV now as well?
Yeah. I mean, it's quite a jump, I suppose, but in a way. But I mean, it's live. Both of them are live. So self-isolating bird club is definitely kind of good. I wouldn't say practice, but it wasn't practice. It was kind of, it was good preparation, I suppose, for me to kind of learn how to do live and interact with the audience and everything. Because live was never something I'd done before. So, yeah, to kind of broadcast live on BBC Two is quite an extraordinary thing.
My next question is, how and when did your love for wildlife and nature begin for you?
This is always a really hard question, because there's, there's not a pinpoint that I can remember to say, you know, it started then. You know, for me, wildlife was just part and parcel of growing up. It was just all around me, because it was all around my stepdad, Chris, because he was, you know, working in natural history. And I would go along with him on film shoots. I would go along when he was just kind of going out into nature reserves, or when he was, you know, bringing back animals to rehabilitate in the downstairs bathroom. I'd be there to help rehabilitate those animals too, or be kind of shocked coming in from school, going in to use the toilet, and there was a, you know, a barn owl or something sat on it instead. So, I mean, that would be kind of a common occurrence. You know, and my bedroom was, you know, something quite kind of wacky, I suppose. I had lime green wallpaper, bright blue bed, and I had kind of tanks with praying mantis in. I had cockroaches at one point. As a young girl, I really appreciate cockroaches. I like them a lot. But as a young girl, they weren't my favourite thing. And I remember kind of Chris saying, oh, well, you need to, you know, love and appreciate everything. So here, have 10 cockroaches, hissing cockroaches, and see how you get on with those. So it was always kind of, you know, anything that I wasn't kind of sure of ended up turning up in my bedroom. So that I kind of got used to all these different animals. But I had all the rabbits and everything as well. But so, you know, at home, there was wildlife in every room, quite literally. You know, the tarantula would be in one room because my mother was terrified. The snake would be in another room away from the poodles, because the poodles would get jealous of the snake getting attention. So,
oh my God.
Yes, yeah, exactly. So it's always kind of something going on inside. And I had a lot of kind of experience, I suppose, going out and seeing wildlife in the wild. You know, whether that was around the UK or travelling abroad, I was very fortunate that I would travel abroad a lot with Chris. And been very fortunate to go to some amazing places and see incredible things from a very early age, and engage with communities as well that were, you know, people that were different from me. And I think that was one of the most influential experiences, was to, you know, understand different ways of thinking and different ways of connecting with wildlife. And so it just stemmed from probably about the age of two, I suppose.
That's an amazing last bit of your answer there as well, because I think that's actually the hardest bit about getting into nature and wildlife, is understanding other perspectives. That's something we've tried to concentrate a lot on our series. And it's, you know, it's easy to, I don't mean this is going to sound negative, but it's easy to love wildlife because wildlife's incredible. But I think it's harder to get that, you know, understanding the other perspectives and how other things happen around the world. Was that a bit of a challenge for you?
I guess it depends on the topic, and it depends, you know, some issues for me are very black and white. Others, you know, there are more kind of grey areas, you know, particularly when it comes to illegal wildlife trade and, you know, what's causing people to, you know, whether it's, you know, I'm a big fan of sharks and bears, and you've got the shark fin trade, the bear bile trade. I mean, what drives the people to kind of catch those sharks or to, you know, keep those bears? And, you know, often it's a lack of education, a lack of opportunities. Yeah, I mean, for me, I always try and think of kind of the other side of things and think kind of pragmatically about what other opportunities are there for people, what can we do, and how can we communicate this better? Because I think very quickly, we kind of get into this kind of two-way argument, and a lot of people kind of look very narrowly down at their view, their belief, and don't consider the bigger picture. And I think we have to have, whether you agree with the other side or not, or whether you agree with aspects of it or not, you know, it's important that we come together and have conversations, because, you know, it can just get into a stalemate very quickly where both sides, neither are backing down, and no one makes any progress for environmental good. So we need to have often difficult and uncomfortable conversations to progress things. And I think it's really important that we are open-minded to that.
Yeah, you're completely right. It very quickly becomes Twitter, and that's the risk. It needs to be like empathy with the conversation as well, I think. So currently, we're going to move on to our main topic. We're currently in winter, and we're going to be talking about this season a lot today. But my first question for you, Megan, is do you have a favourite season?
No, would be the answer. I mean,
right, next question.
Yeah. No, I think I go into every season and I kind of think, oh, this is beautiful. This is my favourite season. And then it will come to the next season and I'll think exactly the same thing. And I think I get excited by the changes and I love visually seeing it happen. And I love seeing the changes in behaviour and, you know, and also the species distribution, what I'm actually seeing in front of me. And I get really excited every time a new arrival comes and I see something new and I'm like, oh, this is amazing. This is the best thing ever. And then, you know, I don't know, spring or summer comes and then I'll say that exact same thing. So, yeah, I mean, I think every season has its absolute gems and I appreciate each and every one of them. For me, winter is perhaps the most kind of beautiful in many ways. You know, I love the early mornings when there's a clear sky. There hasn't been much of that at the moment, but when, you know, the sun burns through and you've got all these beautiful colours and you've got frost on ice on the ground and it's all just sparkling. You know, I live in the New Forest and there's a lot of heathland and I take the dogs out quite early in the morning and it is the most peaceful, kind of beautiful time. Get out in the cold, wrap up warm. It kind of blows all the cobwebs away so you're ready for the day. And it's just, yeah, stunning with the ground just glistening with the frost. Yeah, it's beautiful.
So I guess my next follow-up question should be, do you have a favourite animal or part of nature you enjoy seeing in a season? So if they're all different, they must bring different things. Do you have a favourite part? I'm keen to get a favourite from you, Megan.
A favourite. I'm really bad at giving favourites because it changes every 5 minutes, if I'm honest, with whatever is in front of me. I mean, this time of year, winter, I mean, I really love owls. I think they're so fascinating and beautiful. And right now, you know, the tawny owls are being incredibly vocal. And because they're kind of getting ready to create their pair bonds because they'll start breeding in kind of February, March time, which is quite early on. So they're being very kind of noisy right now, which is great. And I love when the sun goes down and you start hearing the tawnies. You know, it's a great time of year to see a lot of different owls because they're making most of, you know, some species making most of the extended daylight hours to catch more food to get them through the cold winter. So things like barn owls, you've got short-eared owls, little owl as well will make use of the daylight. So it's a great time to kind of go owl watching if you can, obviously within regulations and keep safe to do so. But that's always for me, you know, a favourite winter spectacle. But you've got, you know, the starling murmurations are fantastic as well. I mean, there's so much you know, biodiversity throughout the UK that is always just really exciting. You know, I love engaging with my local badger set, which, you know, is a very special set because we've got so many different colours of badger within the group.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we've got aesthetic individuals, we've got melanistic individuals, we've got typical coloured individuals. So there's a lot of kind of, genetic mutations within the group, but they are, but they're, you know, they're all incredibly successful, you know, doing really well in, you know, there's a couple youngsters there we had this year, but they're all doing really well as adults. It doesn't seem to impact their survival whatsoever, having these kind of light colour variations. Some of them are kind of like a kind of a rose gold kind of rose colour. It's beautiful. And there's a paler individual as well. It seems to, you know, they seem to do really well, despite being kind of light coloured. But they're beautiful to watch and they've got the biggest kind of character. So getting to know them and just spending time sitting down, you know, not thinking and doing anything else, but just focusing on them is always kind of a highlight. I think it just is something which is indescribable because you get an insight into, you know, an animal's life, which is normally quite elusive and secretive, but if you spend, you know, enough time and do it in the right way, which is kind of respectful to the animals, then you can see and learn so much from them. And I find it just kind of grounds me. I love it.
Yeah, that's lovely. What it made me laugh when you first said it, when you're like engaging with my local badger set. I was like, oh my god, that sounds like a novel from the 80s.
You could, the dramas at the badger set, you could write a novel. It's like a natural history EastEnders.
When you say engaging, then is that just like, do you just kind of watch and like take photos, or is it kind of, do you do more work with them? Or this sounds like I'm suggesting you're going around for tea. I don't mean that.
If they invited me, I'd happily accept, but I feel like that's going to be a little while before I get invited to a badger tea party. Yeah, so you know, badger watching is a great thing to do. You know, right now they're quite sleepy. They don't hibernate, but they sleep for a lot of the winter. So there's not too much, you know, as much activity as there is in spring and summer and autumn. But yeah, I mean, it tends to be kind of wildlife watching, really. So always kind of go and sit downwind of them. They've got incredibly sensitive noses. They've got really, you know, a good sense of smell. That's how they find, you know, their primary source of food. So you sit downwind of them so they can't smell you, because if they get a sniff of you, they'll often dart back into their burrows and hide away, dart back into the set. So yeah, sit downwind, sit far enough away that they're going to be comfortable with you. You know, they might approach you later on, but stay dead still. And don't kind of make any fast movements or noises, because they're very sensitive to sound as well. So yeah, you kind of build up confidence and trust a little bit. So I've been watching this set now for over a year, and they know how I smell, because if the wind changes, suddenly they'll get a gust of wind and, you know, it will all kind of smell of me, a smell of human. And they kind of initially, when that would happen, they would all kind of scarper and run away. And now they are incredibly kind of tolerant, so much so that they, you know, they come right up, and that I've had, you know, a badger nose literally touching the lens of my camera.
What?
And I never sit that close. You know, you always want to respect wildlife and give it the space.
Yeah.
But this particular cub was quite curious and decided to come up and have a look what was going on. I'm not sure if she was quite distracted by the peanuts and the earthworms that were around, and I think she kind of got a bit up close and had a smell, and she thought, oh, this is quite close now, and she kind of slowly backed off. But she, you know, she was so kind of happy to be kind of getting a bit of a winter treat with some peanuts.
Oh my god, what an amazing experience though. Did you get a picture?
Yes, I've photographed them quite a lot. That was kind of our, Chris and I had a kind of a bit of a kind of a lockdown photography competition with them. He'd go out one day, I'd go out the next, and we'd both come back saying, look what I got, and we'd kind of, you know, rival of who got the best photo and everything. So yeah, it's a good opportunity for photography.
That's why you were taking the peanuts out.
Yes, yeah, you got to, you know,
this was a competition element.
Chris and I are slightly competitive when it comes to taking wildlife photos. We always have been. But yeah, I mean, peanuts are really good, you know, such a great source of nutrients, particularly at this time of year when food is scarce. You know, so if you can drop a handful of, you know, peanuts, definitely unsalted. Salt is, you know, incredibly bad for wildlife. So if you're ever feeding birds or mammals or anything, make sure that you get kind of very raw seed or nuts and put it down, because it's a... it can be, you know, really important, and they do, you know, semi-rely on, you know, what they can find if we drop it. So, yeah, a few extra handfuls of peanuts will go a long way.
And get you that winning photo.
Yeah, or invited to a badger tea party, I don't know.
Yeah, that's the next thing. You're going to have to take, like, a pecan pie or something like that.
Yeah, that would be a bit extra.
So now let's focus really on winter. Now, many people will feel the need to kind of stay in this time of year. Of course, we've got the dreaded C word that I'm not going to mention, which we are being told to stay in. But outside of that, we've also got that kind of want to hibernate a little bit ourselves. It's, you know, it's colder, it's wetter. But what can winter offer people looking for wildlife to go out? Because I think that the knee-jerk reaction is to assume nothing's there and to assume that everything's hibernating or everything's gone somewhere else. But for the UK, that's really not the case. And a lot of stuff comes here because it's actually warmer. So what kind of things can people be looking for in winter in England?
Oh, well, there's so much to see. I mean, like I mentioned earlier, you've got all the owls, which are making use of the daylight. So that's a great time to go and see, you know, barn owls. If you want to, you know, their favourite food is voles. So you want to go to a vole habitat. So you want to go to open fields where, you know, as the sun is rising or setting, and you can often see these kind of gorgeous white owls, and they just look ghostly as they're kind of hunting across the fields. Amazing. It's one of my favourite things. Starling murmurations are beautiful at this time of year. They're all kind of grouped together in big flocks, and they make these beautiful patterns across the sky, which is stunning as they're kind of going into roost.
Amazing videos this year of that, I've noticed. Yeah. Sorry to interrupt there, but I've seen some amazing Twitter videos I've never seen any other year of going like, good lord, that's incredible.
It's beautiful, isn't it? They're just the most incredible spectacle. You know, I haven't been to see one in a couple of years now, and I would really love to go. I think Iolo Williams went up to an RSPB site in Wales and had the most incredible experience with thousands of them, and he posted that, and it's just I mean, it's one of those highlights, I think, about winter. really beautiful thing. So if you do live close to a Starling commemoration and you can get there safely within regulations, then definitely, you know, go and see it.
When I saw some of them, I was like, you can now, when you see a commemoration like that, it's like you can understand why people like 300 years ago believed in spirits and like evil spirits in the sky, because it's like if you see it from a distance you'd be like, what is that? If you had no idea.
No, it would look, okay, the way they all kind of move in synchrony and it does very much look kind of quite spirit-like, I suppose. Yeah. Definitely. Yeah. Yeah, you can see, and it's, you know, quite dark and ominous as well, I guess, but it's a beautiful thing to go and see. But yeah, there's loads of things, you know, a lot of Arctic visitors are arriving because obviously, you know, it's quite chilly at the moment for us here, but for them, as you said, it's kind of a warm kind of summer, I suppose, from in comparison to the Arctic at the moment. So, I mean, lots of waders you can see just going down on the shoreline is a, you know, a fantastic thing. Lots of cranes as well kind of coming in. So cranes are a really good thing to be able to go out and see as well. And you know, obviously all your foxes and badgers are still there. So go out and kind of engage with those. You know, it is colder. It is a little bit chillier. But just put on an extra jumper. You know, I put on a scarf and some gloves because it is a lot of life out there, lots of things going on. You know, you see mixed flocks in the woodland, which is really exciting, because, you know, obviously safety in numbers, and without the foliage on the leaves and the trees, the birds of prey, things like the goshawk and the peregrine falcons, and are able to kind of hunt slightly easier because there is less obstacles with the leaves being gone. So, you know, you can see some amazing glimpses of birds of prey as well, and hunting these kind of mixed flocks of birds as they kind of group together in an attempt to confuse the predators. So, yeah, there's lots of spectacles out there. It's just getting out and going and seeing them. You know, put on an extra pair of socks and see what you can find and, you know, explore safely, because it is all going on still. It hasn't, you know, all gone into hibernation. There's still so much activity, lots of visitors, as you say. So, yeah, it's worth getting out a little bit earlier, I suppose.
Now, I'm in a city, I'm in London, I'm in North London, and I often find it harder to, I wouldn't say see some wildlife, because I can go and find wildlife. It's, I guess the diversity is slightly slimmer to find, and often it's the urban side of things. But I often find, even more so in winter, it can really be reduced, because it's, you know, it's a different environment. But what can city folk do? Like, what kind of, is there certain species that favour cities for any reasons? Or is there like areas around England where city wildlife really comes into its time in winter?
Yeah, absolutely. There's lots of kind of different examples. You know, the cities are a lot warmer than the countryside. So there are some species which are drawn, you know, things like the pied wagtail, for example. They spend a lot of their time in the summer in the countryside, but then they come into the cities often at winter. I mean, it's just been Christmas and we had those incredible photos of pied wagtails that were roosting in a Christmas tree on the high street.
Yeah.
And you know, and it was the most beautiful thing, but I assume because it's, you know, it is warmer in the cities and it must be extra warm in a tree that's lit up. So they took kind of roost in that tree, and it was quite an unusual thing to see. And I mean, I was out filming yesterday, and I was sat on a bench and a pied wagtail was coming and sat right next to me. So they are, you know, in the cities, they're a great thing to look out for. Of course, your foxes, urban foxes too, making use of kind of the scraps that we leave, and, you know, taking advantage of kind of living next to humans. And there's a really interesting relationship there, that foxes are kind of domesticating more so and diverging almost from kind of their rural counterparts. But there'll be more coming on this later on. And yeah, there'll be, you know, so it is really interesting to go out and see kind of our urban foxes and connect with them. And, you know, it's great to wander around, try and find out where they are. But the best thing you can do if you do live in a city is to do some research, you know, get online, find out what's going on in your cities and your local green spaces, look at different forums to find out what other people have seen and where they saw it, and that's the best way that you can be sure of kind of what's there and how to find it and how to do so safely. But you can also encourage it in, you know, if just because you can't see it doesn't mean it's not there. You just might have to be looking for, you know, either evidence of it, so you could go around looking for kind of footprints in the frost on the pavement side, or you could go you know, in the mud if you have a garden, or looking for kind of droppings as well. But encourage it in, you know, put out a bird feeder, because, you know, it's still an important source for birds in winter. And you can kind of, whether you've got a balcony or, you know, a rooftop or whatever, a windowsill, there's always something that you can do to make your kind of little outdoor space much better for wildlife.
Yeah, I agree with those last couple of bits, because I know last week I my listeners know I run a dog daycare company as well, so I'm out 5 days a week. I'm out walking.
Brilliant.
And some days you can really get distracted and just be like work with the dogs. And then last, I think it was like Wednesday or something like that, we were walking. It was a lovely blue sky winter day, and I felt so much positive afterwards. And then I was like, why today, why? And then I realized that I had looked down so much more and taken pictures of like frost on leaves and stuff like that, and I'd taken pictures of the sky and some birds. I was like, that's why. I just slowed down and looked around rather than assuming nothing was there. I had been looking around so much more. I was like, oh, I'm feeling so much happier now. So I think that's the other thing as well, slow down and actually look.
Yeah, it does wonders for our mental health. You know, it really, really significantly helps. You know, not just, you know, a lot of research has been done on this topic in the last few years. And it's not only just getting out and walking in a green space. That does help, of course. Mm-hmm. But you see real significant results in improvement in our mental health when, you know, you slow down and you take time to engage with what's around you. You know, you look at the leaves, look at the fractal patterns. Our brains really respond to symmetry, and leaves and branches, everything has perfect kind of symmetry. And when looking at that, we see a massive kind of influx in our happy hormones, and it makes us feel so much better. And, you know, seeing, you know, the sunrises, sunsets, all of that, that also really contributes. Anything kind of spectacular and beautiful, just to sit and watch and take the time is really important. And I think for me as well, if I'm out and about and I'm in a rush going somewhere, I don't see anything. You know, even if I'm kind of looking around, but I've got to be somewhere or something, my eyes don't pick up on it. And if we take time, just sit on a bench, and we stay still and we kind of look, suddenly, you know, the place you're in becomes alive. You start noticing the intricate movements of the animals around you, and your eyes become better at picking up exactly what's there. So often that can really kind of go a long, long way in helping. But if you, you know, can't get outside to a big green space, you know, research has also shown that even just kind of watching on a screen, like watching a wildlife documentary, watching, you know, engaging on social media with looking at photos of that wildlife is still really beneficial and helps too. So there's always ways of connecting with nature, and it's just important that we slow down, stop, and appreciate what's there, because it will make us feel better, and also it will kind of hopefully engage us more with wildlife and entice us to protect it more, so it will help wildlife too.
Now, we said earlier, like, people, I think, and I don't think I'm speaking on behalf of everyone, because I think I'm just speaking Ryan's mind, but it's I would imagine people struggle to appreciate winter a lot, and I imagine that because it can be an uncomfortable, physically uncomfortable time of year for some people. To heighten their appreciation, why is a season like winter actually important for, like, animals or wildlife?
It's a really important time of year. I mean, it's crucial for any organism. You know, winter provides this kind of reset button. You know, spring and summer is incredibly busy for them, and they, you know, the wildlife is expending a lot of energy in reproducing, in kind of mating behaviors, in fighting off rivals, whether that's, you know, due to territory or for mate competition. It's a lot that goes into spring and summer, you know, rearing young. I mean, all of the energy that goes in, you know, providing enough food, it is utterly exhausting. I mean, I feel exhausted, you know, watching some of the birds and how busy they are, you know, flying back and forth, trying to find the caterpillars to feed their young and fighting off all that, you know, dawn chorus, you know, singing their hearts out from early in the morning. I mean, it's a lot of energy that goes into it. And they need time to build up their reserves. They need that time in order to kind of get some rest by a little bit and reset, so that they're prepared for the next season. And that's why, you know, even though, you know, some food sources are down throughout winter because of that cold, there's also a lot that's up. You know, the berries in the hedgerows and everything is really, really critical for that wildlife to kind of rebalance itself and get a bit of, you know, downtime, I suppose, in some ways, depending on the species. And for plants, it's really important as well, because they, you know, it's important that they shed their leaves because of issues when it comes to kind of disease, or, you know, that their leaves might have been eaten by caterpillars. So they have to kind of get rid of the ones from the previous season to start again. So it is a reset button. It's everything kind of takes a step back. It's still there. It's still active, and it's still magnificent. but it's just taking a bit of a breather to build up its energy again before it all springs back into action, quite literally.
That's a really lovely way of putting it, actually. Like, it's a reset button. It's everything going, all right, everything stop. Like,
yeah.
let's go through for the next season. It's like a theme park getting ready to open up again. Do you know what I mean? Let's have a good clean up and start again.
Yeah, and there's still rides going on. You know, they're still being active and, you know, doing their thing and being brilliant. But it's just they're kind of, getting a bit of a rest and kind of either molting as well. You know, a lot of birds will be molting, or will have, you know, molted in the autumn after the breeding season. So yeah, it's still a lot going on, still a lot to see, but it's just a slightly different pace, a slightly different kind of behavioural repertoire that you'll see.
I think we just come up with a perfect analogy as well.
Oh yeah.
With a theme park. There's still a few rides open, guys. It's just not the full show right now.
Yeah. It's the practice, you know, before it opens and they send the practice carts up.
Yeah. It's a slow opening, guys. We're getting ready for it.
Yeah, it's the build up.
So, right, let's talk about Winter Watch. You ready?
Oh, yeah, always ready.
So, you're currently, I mean, you're working very hard to prepare for this, as are many people. I don't know how much you can say, but what can we expect from this year's instalment with the added challenge of lockdown 3?
Yeah, I mean, the watches this year has been the most amazing thing, I think, from a technical perspective, because, you know, it's very different from previous years because all presenters are located around the country. And that means that you're kind of live streaming from different locations, different areas, and trying to put it all together, matching the times up so there's not a lag or a delay, and making sure that everything runs smoothly. And I think that's going to be particularly, you know, it will bring new challenges for Winter Watch because it is cold, and you know, technology doesn't always do as well in the cold and the wet as it does in the kind of the warm and the dry. But there's, you know, an amazing dedicated team who are working around the clock to, you know, make this so successful as it has been in spring and autumn watch. And I think, you know, it's going to be an amazing technical feat. And I think it's going to be really, really brilliant. And I'm really excited to see it. So, yeah, I mean, there are technical challenges with doing it like this. But I think actually it adds a whole new element to it. You know, I think it's quite nice having the presenters dotted around the country because you get snapshots.
Snippets and snapshots.
You get snippets and snapshots of of what it's like, what wildlife is doing all around the country, and you get kind of an insight into the areas. You know, I've grown up in the New Forest, so I can talk about it really passionately because it's home. And it's nice, you know, I love being able to share that with the nation. And I know kind of Yolo, Gillian feel the same as well. And of course, you know, very much missing Michaela. Michaela can't be joining us for Winter Watch because she is in South Africa. So we will miss her, you know, greatly. But, you know, I know that she'd feel the same if she was kind of doing it from a location as well. So, yeah, it's going to be an amazing series. I'm really excited by some of the science and some of the stories that we've got coming up, and trying to get people to go out and connect with nature is a really important theme for this series. I think trying to get people to explore what they can on their doorstep, whether that's just within their gardens, whether that is, you know, in their green spaces on their hourly exercise, just to engage with it a little bit more to help our mental health, because obviously this is a really difficult time for everyone in our lockdown. So yeah, there's going to be lots of fantastic, fascinating, unusual, you know, odd stories which are going to come out of this. For me, I'm going to be looking at challenging people's reputations of animals which are, you know, don't always have the best favor with people. So you know, so I'm going to be kind of trying to get people to think again about species like, you know, jellyfish. We're going to be looking at rats. I'm going to be looking at pigeons and potentially slugs as well. So trying to change mindsets. Oh dear, this is really bad. I'm kind of,
it's Monday morning at 9 a.m.
Trying to change people's perceptions of these incredible creatures and trying to get more appreciation for the important ecological work that they do.
That's a really interesting job that you've got on the show, considering that's what Chris did to you with the cockroaches.
I hadn't thought of it like that, actually. It kind of, it's come around full circle, hasn't it? Yeah, no, I'm a big fan of the underdog. I like I like challenging people's mindsets. I really find, I think that's an important thing to do. I think it's important that we challenge ourselves in that way. I mean, I'm always doing that. I'm always trying to kind of check myself for, you know, opinions on certain animals or opinions on certain situations and try and evolve with current information. And I think that's something as humans that we're quite reluctant to do, is to change our minds. You know, we don't really like doing it very often, but we have to change our mind when it comes to biology, when it comes to zoology, when it comes to environmental issues and concerns, because with every new piece of information, we should be able to build upon our opinions and be able to be flexible enough to adjust them. And there's a lot that we've learned, you know, now and in the past few years about these animals, you know, jellyfish, rats, pigeons and slugs, that is just mind-blowing. It's really, really cool. And I'm really excited to kind of share it with everyone and hopefully kind of challenge their, unfavoured reputations.
If you're not allowed to, this is fine. But what can you tell me about what can you tell me about jellyfish that might change someone's mind? If you need to save it for the show, I get that.
I'll need to save the headline for the show, definitely.
Yeah.
I think the diversity of jellyfish around the UK is something people don't kind of expect. I mean, we've got six species around the UK, and they are so very beautiful. You know, we've got something for like the barrel jellyfish, which is one of the largest, well, it is the largest that we have around the UK. And it can get up to, I think it's like over 2 meters long.
What?
And it's huge. It's absolutely huge. And it's a kind of a friendly giant. You know, it doesn't, you know, it has, every jellyfish has stinging cells, but it's about how kind of strong those stings are in terms of whether the kind of harpoons, which sting us from their stinging cells, are able to penetrate human skin. And for this case, on the majority, they're kind of very kind of, you don't have to be worried in the water with them. But barrel jellyfish are kind of quite a spectacle to be able to go and see. And then you've got things like the moon jellyfish, which are kind of much smaller, and they're kind of the most common species of jellyfish that we see around UK waters. And they are kind of this translucent, clear colour, but you kind of often see the outline when you look into the shore or when you look into kind of, you know, different reservoirs of water. And they are very, very beautiful. So, yeah, we'll be kind of exploring a little bit about, you know, why they've got the reputations they do, a little bit about kind of the stinging, and a little bit about actually, you know, they are pretty important animals and they're very beautiful as well.
Amazing. I'm looking forward to that. I love a jellyfish.
Me too. I'm a big fan.
They're amazing. Now, that was really interesting to hear, because you were really optimistic with how you were talking about the watches and how they've worked throughout lockdown and how this one will as well. Again, I'm going to share that optimism. Do you find that lockdown has helped yourself and the other presenters connect more with the public in regards to it being online and being remote? Do you think that's actually been, again, if we're looking at the glass half full, a bit of a benefit in presenting a show like that?
Yeah, I mean, definitely in some ways, I think so. I think people have, you know, reconnected with nature on their own accord throughout the course, you know, particularly the first lockdown in the spring, and now in this lockdown too. I think a lot of people, because as we said earlier, you know, they have more time. There isn't this kind of rush to, you know, get in the car, get the kids to school, get to work, get everyone's lunch sorted, run back home, all knackered, go to sleep. You know, there isn't this kind of daily kind of routine so much anymore. People are either working from home, you know, reliant on Zoom, like, you know, we're talking right now. You know, things are done remotely. And with that being the case, there is more time in the day. And therefore, people are spending much more time outdoors, you know, making use of that 1 hour. Because, you know, before we were kind of given this 1 hour allowance, you know, it wouldn't have been a priority to kind of go out for an hour's walk. Whereas now, because, you know, we do, okay, we're allowed to go out for an hour, we must make the most of this hour. So people are kind of, I think, there's a psychological element to it there, people making the most of that hour, and they're going and exploring. And there's this kind of, I found this new interest in wildlife. People were seeing things differently, things that they'd seen 100 times before, but they hadn't really seen it, if you know what I mean. They, you know, think people were taking the time to really understand what's on their doorstep and appreciate it and engage with it more. And I think because of that, you know, there's a lot of interest in the watches this year, because they've kind of seen the, you know, these amazing animals, looking at them differently and wanting to know more about them. So yeah, I think there is this kind of renewed interest, and it helped get me through lockdown. I think it helped the nation get through lockdown, and that's the best thing I think about the watches this year, is that they've really provided that escapism. They've provided that kind of solace and that kind of comfort, because you can be transported, I think, with these programs. you know, your head isn't thinking about the news. It's not thinking about the headlines and, you know, everything that's come out that day and the you know, the horrible tragedy that we're all facing. It gives us a little bit of a, you know, escapism from that. And we can look at something wonderful. And also life is continuing, you know, whilst we're locked in our homes, whilst that's really difficult for us. You know, the wildlife out there is still going about its business as usual. And I think there's something quite comforting in that. And I think a lot of people are taking that in quite a heartwarming way. So that's really nice to see. And that's, for me, you know, a really important role that the Watchers have played this year.
Yeah, could not agree more. It really has. I think it's like you said, that people are already doing it, but it's given people that boost that, you know, they might need at certain times as well. And I think it's great that it's just a full circle. We get it all year round as well. My penultimate question to you is something we spoke about quite briefly at the beginning, was the self-isolating bird club. Now, you told us a bit about what it was, but can you give us a little bit more about how that came around, like how, or what your expectation of what it was going to be to what it turned into?
We went into it with absolutely zero expectations or plans at all. You know, it was kind of a spontaneous thing. It started in March, and I can remember the first morning that it started, because I was it was like 7 a.m. and I could hear Chris talking. I had my bedroom window open, and we went through lockdown together. We isolated together. So we were in a kind of a cottage in the New Forest, which is, you know, very lucky to have the wildlife and plant diversity around us. And it was like 7 a.m. and I could hear him talking outside. And I thought, that's just a bit odd. What is he doing? And I kind of peeked out my bedroom window, and he's kind of kneeling down in a patch of celandines, and he's kind of talking to his phone. And I thought, okay, right, well, but, you know, I mean, that's kind of one of the most normal things to happen, to be honest. It's quite, you know, with stuff that the stuff that he does, you know, that's quite ordinary, I suppose, in a way. So I kind of didn't think very much of it. And then he came in after walking the dogs, and I said, what are you doing? And he said, well, you know, notice this patch of celandine. And, you know, he thought that they were really beautiful. They just kind of emerged. And he wanted to share that with the nation. So he did a Facebook Live, because he thought, well, if this makes me happy, it might make other people happy just to see it if they don't have a patch of celandines, you know, local to them. So he just did this really kind of rough and ready kind of miniature SIBC on celandines. And then he started doing them twice a day, and he would just kind of pick up things on his walk, or he would find something that had emerged or something beautiful, and he would just kind of sit and talk about it. So he did that for, I think, 3 or 4 days in a row, and then he had to go to do some filming somewhere. And this was before, you know, the major lockdown kicked in. So we were all kind of staying at home, but it wasn't, you know, as strict as it then developed to be. So he had to go off to do some filming, and he said, well, people were expecting it now, Megan, we have to do it. You have to continue it whilst I'm gone. So I ended up talking about fox skull versus badger skulls. And I did kind of a comparison of different feather types and why, you know, primary feathers, down feathers were all important, and what their purpose was, and where, you know, on the birds they are. So it kind of then developed from there. So we started then doing them together every day. Started doing them twice a day, and they were quite, you know, we just had our phones up, and we were just kind of pointing our phones. It was all very wobbly and a very you know, unprofessional probably. And Fabian Harrison, who's a really good friend of ours that we've worked with for a long time, who lives in Norwich, he is, you know, a brilliant young naturalist, and he's just brilliant when it comes to anything techie. So he kind of said, guys, what are you doing? I mean, it's just really bumpy and messy on your phones. You know, we can make this so much better. So he kind of had the idea to, you know, get the laptops out, start, you know, Skyping and bring artifacts in, you know, quiz of the day we started doing. And we spoke about the wildlife that we had in and around us in the New Forest, the things that we were seeing, you know, the scientific concepts as well. So it was all, you know, we talked about the biology of structural colour. We talked about you know, bird boxes, when to put them up, what sizes they should be, how to make them, how to do a wildlife pond. But then we also kind of got guests in from around the world. So we had Michaela Strachan in South Africa, we had Yolo Williams, we had Gillian, we had, you know, all the kind of the Watchers crew, but we also had many other kind of people as well. We had Adara McNaughty, who's a fantastic, fantastic young naturalist in Northern Ireland. And then, you know, we had Indy Green, Ruth Peacey. We had this kind of array of different people that would kind of give us a snippet of what was going on in their gardens as well. And it then started this kind of community of people on our Facebook group, And people, it was the most amazing space to watch unfold, because people would say, oh, I've just seen this, what is it? And there would be a discussion about it, or, you know, I've just taken this photo, I've done this painting of this robin. And it became this kind of hub for anybody who had an appreciation for natural history during lockdown, you know, whether that was somebody who had just found that appreciation or whether it was kind of somebody who had more experience. It was a really kind of supportive community of people asking questions and engaging and supporting one another. And, you know, it became a really kind of humble place where people would share their stories, you know, their difficulties about the time and how kind of nature had helped save them. So it was totally unexpected and unplanned. And to see it evolve how it did was the most amazing thing, really. And yeah, so we were doing an hour a day for I think 3 months, and now we're doing them every Sunday. Times change a little bit depending. Chris and I are both back at work now doing kind of filming or writing or doing something. So yeah, times change a little bit, but we do an hour a week. So yeah, we love it.
It's amazing. And I think I've been keeping an eye on it, and I think it's going to be really interesting to see where it goes as well, because it's something that's just going to develop for a very long time. Because I think, like you said, you've probably unintentionally but very gladly created a lovely community of people that are like-minded and just want to share a love for nature. And I think that's, you know, whether in and out of lockdown, that's an incredible valuable thing to have.
Yeah, it's an amazing community, and you know, the way that people support one another on it is fantastic. And you know, it started off as a celebration of nature. You know, we wanted no bad news whatsoever. We wanted it all to be kind of good and positive, because at that time that is definitely, you know, what we all needed, and right now that's still certainly what we need. So it is a kind of a celebratory platform, but it's also one of conversation where we do talk about environmental issues and we try and encourage those who had that invested interest in wildlife and nature to then do something for it, whether that is put in a pond, whether that is start feeding the birds, or whether that's, you know, writing to your MPs to ask for, you know, policy changes. So it's a you know, a platform for celebration, and also hopefully, you know, it's emerging as a platform for change too.
You've created a social media platform of positivity. You've nailed it. No one's ever done it. You both should just make a new app. Like, you've absolutely nailed it.
Well, I think the wildlife has nailed it for us. I think, you know, it's
yes,
for
yes.
itself, really.
My last question is our Into the Wild question, and it's a hard one to ask people, and I do appreciate that. But if you could pass on one bit of advice onto everyone regarding nature and the natural world, Megan, what would you pass on?
Do something. Just nice. Do something. Do something different from yesterday. You know, whether you wake up 15 minutes earlier to look at that sunrise to make yourself feel better, you know, for your mental health, that's, you know, brilliant. Whether you start feeding the birds, whether you start, you know, sharing things on social media, environmental causes, whether you start talking about it, you know, let your friends know about the issues in when it comes to the, you know, the biodiversity and climate crisis. You know, do something different from yesterday to make the world a slightly better place.
I really like that. That's a lovely way to end as well. Megan, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you on Into the Wild. Good luck with the week coming up, and all the best for the watches, with the Winter Watch coming up. And we'll keep in touch, and I'm sure we'll speak again soon.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for having me. Really enjoyed it. It's been really good fun, and it will be really looking forward to Winter Watch. So hope you enjoy that as well.
Thanks again for listening. If you'd like to keep up to date with the projects and work Megan is working on, you can do so on Instagram at Megan_McCubbinPhoto and on Twitter at MeganMcCubbin. Don't forget you can now become a part of Into the Wild's Patreon at www.patreon.com/IntoTheWildPodcast and gain access to exclusive shows, including a short extra episode with Megan. You can also get in touch with us at IntoTheWildPod@gmail.com or on social media at IntoTheWildPod on Twitter and IntoTheWildPodcast on Instagram. Whether it's just to say hello, share some thoughts on an episode, or even let me know what you want to hear about next. Until next time, keep well, stay safe, and live the good life.